getting right to it. Hey, everybody, I'm Jennifer, a grateful alcoholic. So y'all are in for a treat tonight. This is Patty. And I have often said, as we've talked, that one of the things that happens in AA is how far down we've gone and how far we come. You know, that story of the in-between pieces becomes so common because we're so used to miracles that I think we forget what an incredible miracle. It is hard to forget what a miracle Patty is, and so I am really honored to be your friend. And here's Patty.
Thank you.
I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's July 4th, 1986. My home group is the Chapter 3 group in Sandy Springs. We meet Tuesdays at 8 and Thursdays at 7. Please come and visit us at North Springs United Methodist Church. You know, I don't think enough about the miracle of recovery for me in AA. I am grateful that I'm sober, but I forget sometimes that I shouldn't be standing before you and sober anyway. And I really shouldn't, because I'm an alcoholic and I really should be drunk. And for me, it's been a long time since my last drink. If I would have still be drinking and progressed at the rate I was progressing, I probably would not be alive at this time. I'm glad you reminded me of that. That's really important for me to think about, especially while I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you all. So I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I grew up in Maryland. Actually, I was born in Pennsylvania, grew up in Maryland. Maryland is actually where I got sober. I moved down here when I had almost 2 years of sobriety, and that's a whole long story in and of itself. But there's six kids in my family. I'm number five of the six, so I'm in what we call the younger half. And I had teenage brothers and sisters when I was 11, 12, and my parents were divorced, and there was a lot of partying going on in my house. And my mother really stopped parenting us when my parents got divorced. She was there. She was always there. But we didn't have a whole lot of rules, and as a result, we did whatever we wanted, and I never had curfews, although 9 o'clock is close to my curfew now. We didn't have curfews. We didn't really have, my mother let us drink at the house. She knew we smoked pot. She knew we smoked cigarettes. She didn't really let us do that, but there wasn't really anything prohibiting us from doing that. And that was kind of the way I grew up. And as a child, I was very, very shy, painfully shy. It was difficult for me to interact with anyone. I had a few friends and my family that I could interact with. But even like my extended family, I was very uncomfortable with. And I remember thinking, watching my teenage brothers and sisters and their friends drinking and having a great time and listening to loud music, driving fast cars, and I thought, that's what I want to do. That's exactly what I want to do. It looks like fun. I don't know how to do that, and maybe if I drank, I could do that. And so the first time I set out to drink, I set out to do that, and what I thought by doing that was, is you have to get drunk. So I did. Now, I had had alcohol before that, when my parents were married, we'd sometimes have cream de menthe over ice cream, or we always got Irish whiskey when we were sick, good Irish Catholic family, and cold duck on New Year's, and occasionally I'd get a sip of my father's beer. But that was kind of the extent of the drinking with my parents. And so when I set out to drink, we got a bottle of Mad Dog 2020, and I got drunk, and I got sick, and I blacked out, and I thought it was the best thing ever. And that's it. And, you know, that one night really is how I drank my whole drinking career. Now, the places changed, the circumstances changed, but I drank to get drunk, and the consequence of that for me was always getting sick. and always blacking out and usually passing out somewhere where I didn't intend to. And and you know, to me, it was a small price to pay for what I got out of it. And you know, what I got out of that was a sense of ease and comfort, really, with who I was and the fact that I could have a good time, relax, you know, go out dancing, do whatever everybody else was doing, and I was comfortable doing that. When I started drinking, I was 12 or 13. I don't really remember. I think probably the summer before I turned 13, to that extent. And I drank as much as a, 12, 13-year-old can. I didn't have any money. My family didn't really have any money. But I would steal what money I could from my mother. And we did get some allowance. And so my friends and I would put our money together, and we'd buy as much as we could. And I would drink all, I would first of all separate my share, and I would drink all of mine, and then I would drink all of yours, because they didn't drink fast enough, and they didn't seem to be as interested as I was in the drinking. So I would, of course, then get drunk. And prior to me starting to drink, I was a pretty good student at school. Even though I was extremely shy, I could do the work and get good grades. I couldn't participate in class, but I could do the work. And when I started drinking and I went back to, it was in the summer, and I went back to school, I guess it must have been seventh or eighth grade, I realized there was a lot going on in the woods behind the school during the day. And a lot of it was people getting beer and meeting in the woods and doing other things, and I wanted to be there. So I quickly figured out that I could skip school, and I wouldn't really have very many consequences for that. And so I would purposely miss the bus so I could walk to school and see what was happening in the woods before I got to school. And if there was a party, I'd stay. If not, I would go to school. And so that's kind of how my school career went from that point forward. And I missed probably about a third of the school year for the next, till I quit school in 12th grade. And in those days, you could pass. You could get promoted to the next grade with missing that much school. And your parents didn't get arrested or any of the stuff that goes on today. And my mother, I would come home from school, and she'd say the school would call, or the school called, where were you? And I would just say I was in the woods, and I'd keep walking right past her. And, I'm sure that there was a lot she wanted to say and do about that, but she just didn't. And occasionally she would blow up and scream at me and say, oh, you're grounded, and, it would last all of a couple hours, and then I would just leave. Or I would just go out the bedroom window and, come back whenever. And and that's kind of how it went at my house. And I didn't really have any legal consequences early on. Just a lot of partying, and I was recently reminded, Facebook is a great thing. A couple of years ago, I connected with my best friend at that time, and she lived in my neighborhood. She was from a very nice family, and not that my people weren't nice, it was just a little crazy. Her people were pretty sane and very nice, and her mother didn't work, and her father was a professional, and they were happily married, and they had three kids, and the house was always very clean and orderly, and I loved to spend the night at her house. And so as I started drinking, we would go out, I would get drunk, we're spending the night at her house, and I end up at her house drunk. Now, in my house drunk, you can pretty much just slip by my mother and go to your room, and nobody really knows, and, whatever happens, happens. In their house drunk, you can't really slip by the parents. And as you know, when someone is throwing up that's drunk in a house that's not very big, everybody knows. If you can't hear it, you can smell it, and if you're not drinking. And I don't know how many times I did that, and I can remember being passed out on their front lawn. They never said a word to me. They never said a word. And I never thought about that until I recently connected with her on Facebook, and I was looking at pictures and, you know, seeing that her parents are still married and they're still living in the same house, and I just thought, wow, what nice people. I mean, they just never said anything. They probably should have said, "Don't bring her back here," is what they probably should have said, and they just didn't. So I didn't go to school. When I was 15, I met my first love, it was really the first time I dated someone, I, of course, and he was older than me. He was 18, and I left home and moved in with him, of course, and at 15. And I, you know, my parents didn't agree with that, but there really wasn't a whole lot they could do. I just went. And by the time I was 16, I was pregnant. And I can remember talking with both of my parents about that, and my father saying to me, my father and his wife tried to convince me to do something other than have a baby and raise a baby at 16, to look at options, which I was incredibly insulted about and couldn't imagine why he would even consider that. And I had a big resentment about that for a long time. And my mother didn't say a whole lot, except that she was not going to raise my baby. My mother had, like, ingrained Al-Anon. She never went to an Al-Anon meeting, but boy, she had it down pat. She didn't need to go. She, you know, that was her thing. I'm not going to raise your child. And so I thought I knew everything, and I'm going to have a baby. I'm in love. We're going to live happily ever after. And I'm 16, and he's 19, and he's a drug dealer, and I'm an alcoholic. And he probably was too. And so the funny thing is, and this is in my story where I see the cunning, baffling, powerful nature of alcoholism, I didn't drink while I was pregnant. And it took me sort of a few weeks to realize, oh, you're pregnant, oh, you better stop these things. But I did, and I didn't drink. The other thing that happened was when I met this guy, I didn't get sloppy drunk. I knew already at 15, when I drink and I get drunk, it's not very attractive. And so I wanted him to like me, and so I didn't do that, which is weird because up until that point, it didn't seem like it was a choice. And then as soon as I had my son, I picked up everything again, and by the time I was 18, I decided that this relationship wasn't working. We didn't get married. We had sort of planned to, but just never got around to it. And I had decided this isn't working. My son shouldn't be being brought up in this lifestyle. And so I'm done with it. Now, I hadn't left yet. I'm just decided I'm done with it. And my drinking took off right away. I didn't care what he thought about me because I'm done with the relationship. And I didn't care. And that was probably, from that point forward, I really never had the ability to do that again. But I realize now that that's alcoholism, you know, and that's how we can trick ourselves into thinking that we don't have a problem. And at 15, I already knew something was wrong. But I thought it was okay because I was able to slow it down for a while. And so, I drank. I just didn't drink as much. So here I am at 18, and I'm back off to the races. And I immediately started staying out all night. And, the whole cycle came of having a child and leaving him with the babysitter and trying to work. And I worked in restaurants and bars. And so I'm working at night and thinking, well, I'm going to work till 11 or 12. I'll just leave him at his grandmother's all night and pick him up in the morning. And that was really so that I could drink all night and pick him up in the morning fresh from wherever I was. And then we'd go home, and I'd sleep on the couch for a couple. I'd put him in front of the TV, and I would sleep on the couch, and I'd wake up, you know, early afternoon and start again. And that's how every day went. And another, from that point in time, another sort of long, late awareness that came and is that his grandmother babysat him a lot, his father's parents, and they are really good people, and they're still very close to him and I, and they, I would roll in there at 8, 9 in the morning reeking of alcohol, I mean reeking, and I would pick that child up and put him in my car and drive him home. Or I'd go in at 3 in the morning and take him out of their bed, reeking of alcohol, and drive him home. And that had to have scared the crap out of them every time I did that, which was several times a week. And I never thought about that. And I didn't think about it until, well, let's see, probably 10, 15 years later when I was writing them a thank you note for making a quilt for my now daughter who's came after I got sober. And that thank you letter turned into an amends letter. I don't know, it just, oh, I was overcome with, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that to those people. And at the time, it didn't seem like I was hurting anybody. You know, and when I hear people, and when I hear myself say, and when I hear people say, I didn't hurt anybody when I was drinking. You know, I think about that, and I think, oh my gosh, yes, I did. I mean, forget the risks that I put myself and my son in, but just the concern that they must have had every time I walked out that door like that. and so, life went on, and you know, a lot of things happened. I lost jobs. I wrecked cars. Surprisingly, I never got arrested. I got pulled over a lot. I got a lot of speeding tickets. But that's when DUIs were not the thing they are today. You know, I can't tell you how many times I was pulled over when I was not fit to drive, and they let me drive. You know, I'd be drinking shots of tequila while I'm driving, see the blue lights, throw it all under my seat, pull over, get the ticket or whatever, and just keep going. And, you know, that would not happen today. And I'm glad that it wouldn't, because I should not have been driving. I could have killed somebody. And a lot of us have. And I can just so see how that happens. And, you know, I really can. And so a lot of that happened. I wrecked cars, you know. I couldn't pay bills, so I moved about every 6 months. I'd move into a place, pay the rent for a few months, and then just couldn't do it anymore. Not that I didn't have money, I was working. I just couldn't pull it all together. I got paid mostly cash, and so you get paid, you get it in your pocket, you spend it, and so by the end of the week or the end of the month, I didn't have any money to pay the bills, and so I would move, and then I'd find another place, and then I would move, and then I might find a boyfriend, and I would move in with the boyfriend, and then I would not like him anymore, and I would move, and, you know, this is what I did every, like, 4 to 6 months for several years with my son in tow, and what happened, a lot happened, but what really happened is when I was, I was 23, and I had was living in an apartment with my son, and I had a lot of roommates and a lot of crazy stuff going on wherever I lived, and this was a particular time where it was just me and him, which was unusual, and I have a big family, 3 sisters, 2 brothers, and my sisters would always be concerned about Billy, really. They weren't necessarily concerned about me. They were really concerned about my son. And so on and off, they would try to help or, you know, do something. And by this time, he's 6. And my sister comes over one day, and I had a house full of people, my friends, which she thought, you know, my whole family, who were all partiers, thought my friends were not, they were, you know, a little scary. Normally, she would have cleared the house because my son was there, and my sister's really bossy. I mean, she would have just come in and cleared the house. But instead, she just said, I'll come back tomorrow, which was different. And then the next day, she came back, and nobody was there, and she asked if I would consider moving in with her. Billy and I, my son Billy, would move in with her. And, my first reaction was, oh, I can't do that. I just, you know, and I just signed a lease here. I mean, I can't move. Now, you've heard the way I lived. I could care less about lease. But I didn't have anything else to throw in front of that except I just signed a lease. And she said to me, I can help you make a home for Billy. And that's when I thought, oh, I need that. I can't do it. I know I can't do it. And this may be the last chance I will get, because my family had tried to help me before, and I just wouldn't cooperate. And so I knew that I had to say yes for him. I just knew I had to. And so I did. We moved in together. It was the three of us. And she had a couple rules for me. The first one was I had to get a normal job, which was a daytime job, you know, a 9-to-5 job. And I got a job bartending during the day. And when you don't understand alcoholism, you don't know that's a problem for somebody like me. And she thought it was fine because my work schedule was 9-to-5. I mean, that sounds fine, doesn't it? And then we were by a case of wine with the groceries. And you can only smoke pot after Billy goes to bed, my son goes to bed, and we have to do a budget. That was the rules. And I thought, well, maybe I can do this. I didn't see the point in most of it, but maybe I could do it. And the other thing was, we're going to have dinner at home every night as a family, and we'll take turns picking Billy up from daycare. So within 2 months, I couldn't live up to any of that, none of it. I couldn't get home on time. I'm in a bar. Happy hour starts at 5. Oh, I'm off work. I'm just going to have one drink, and then we're going down the street to the next bar, and then, you know what happens after that. And she didn't say a whole lot to me about it, but I knew I wasn't able to live up to the few simple rules. And although I wasn't able to act on any of this knowledge, I knew that what she was asking of me was best for my son. It wasn't had nothing to do with me. It was really best for him. And I still couldn't do it. What was the final straw for me is I think it was a Sunday night. It was my friend's birthday, and she has a son the same age as mine. And we wanted to go out. And I had asked my sister to babysit, which I always did. And she said no, which she usually did. And bless you. And she said no. So what we did is we put the kids to bed, and we left anyway and went out, and which is what I did anyway. And so she said no, but I left them anyway, and she was babysitting. And so we stayed out till the bars closed. We came home, stayed up all night, and it was that morning that I just looked at myself in the mirror, and I just thought, I don't even know who you are. And, it was a feeling of just complete and utter... I was just appalled with myself that I just couldn't do the simple things. And, I sometimes say that my son saved my life because it was him that I was worried about. You know, it was her that I was not living up to her expectations, but it was because all she wanted was the best for him. And she knew I couldn't do it by myself. And guess what? She was right. I couldn't do it. And so that morning, I called in sick to work, and I overdosed. Now, I don't know if I did that on purpose. I don't really remember what I was thinking. I could have been just trying to get a buzz. Who knows? I overshot many a time. So I don't know what happened, but what ended up happening is I overdosed. And my boyfriend at the time... He my family did not like him, and he didn't like my family. I mean, he was sort of one of those undesirable people that I hung out with. And he, in and out of jail, you know, lifetime criminal. He's probably in jail right now. And so he called my sister, which, again, a miracle, because why would he? I don't even know how he knew to get a hold of her, how to get a hold of her. And so, because they didn't even speak to each other. I mean, there was, like, nothing. And so he called her. She came home from work and somehow convinced me to go to the hospital. And I went, and she knew what she was doing. She was taking me to the detox of our local hospital. She worked there and knew about the detox and knew what you had to do to get somebody in. Evidently, she had done a little research. And so there I was. And this was the first time that I ended up in a place like that for me. I had gone to a few AA meetings with boyfriends who had DUIs, or DWIs is what we call them, but I don't remember anything about him. I wasn't there to hear anything. I was there to just get past that hour so he could get his papers slipped and signed and we could leave. And so I knew nothing about recovery. What I knew about treatment is some of my friends would go away and they would come back, and that was that. And, you know, if you lived the lifestyle I did and anybody came back from treatment, they weren't sober, and they weren't in any kind of program. And so I really didn't know what happened there or anything. And so here I am getting into this detox and really having no idea. But what I did know is after my sister kept saying to me, it's only 7 days, and if you don't like it, you can leave. And I was very agitated. I do remember that. And she was holding my hand, and they were asking me a lot of questions, which is why I was agitated. And finally I just said, okay, I'll stay. And I had the greatest sense of relief that I've ever had in my life. And so I had no idea what I was in for or anything. I didn't know that they were going to tell me I probably shouldn't drink or I probably shouldn't use drugs or any of that stuff. And but for some reason, at that moment, I had a spiritual experience that allowed me to say, I'll give this a try. And I had no idea what it was. And I ended up in treatment, and I was there for 7 days, or in detox. I was there for 7 days, and when it was time to leave, I was afraid to go home. I learned about alcoholism when I was in there, and I heard the things about you have to change your playmates and your playgrounds, and I realized that I wasn't a bad person, that I was an alcoholic, and that there was a program of recovery. I still had no idea what it was about, but I had a little hope. And I was afraid to go home because, guess what, nothing had changed at home. And, I live with my sister, and my son was there, but all my friends, the job, the whole thing was still sitting there waiting for me to step back in like I had seen everybody else do. And so I called my sister and asked her if she'd keep my son for a month while I went into a 28-day program, and she did. and I went home. I think I went home for a week, and then I went into that program. And that began my journey. And what happened there is I got exposed to AA. I learned about recovery, and then when I got out, I knew what I needed to do to stay sober. You know, it was up to me to do it, but I knew what I needed to do. And I was far from the perfect, Jennifer says I'm rigid about AA, but I was far from the perfect AA person, especially that first year. I didn't change very much behavior. And, you know, from the day I got out of treatment to getting picked up at the treatment facility by my former drug dealer, who then takes me to the courthouse because my best friend has a child custody hearing and I'm her character witness. I'm telling you, hours out of treatment. And luckily I did not have to go, I didn't have to be a witness for her, but I was there just in case she needed me. See, this is the thinking. I went from the courthouse. There, I met up with my former attorney, who I was having a married attorney who I was having an affair with, and I left there to go with him to his office. I think he was going to take me home, but then he ended up getting caught up in work. And all this time, my sister and my son are at home cooking me a welcome home dinner, and I'm like hours late because this is what I'm doing. This was more important. So my thinking didn't change right away. And you know, my behavior didn't change right away. And some of the things that I, you know, didn't piece together for a long time is the day I walked into treatment, I had a boyfriend who went into jail, actually, the day I went into treatment, which every time the police saw him, he got locked up. He was that kind of guy. And so he went into jail. I was having an affair with my lawyer. I was having an affair with a drug dealer. And I was still having relationship with my son's father. All of that at the same time, and really didn't even know that for a long time. And maybe she was my second sponsor. I went through several sponsors before I figured out that whole thing. And like, you got to call them. and so my sponsor, who had been sober a year or two, I don't remember how long, I drank with her, and I forgot where I knew her from, but that's why I asked her, quite honestly, because I knew her from drinking. And she was still having affairs with married men, and I don't know, another sort of moment of clarity, I thought, you know what, I don't think we're supposed to be doing that. And so that was good. And so I stopped calling her, and I then later found another sponsor. But so I was slowly sort of getting this whole thing, but it was very slow the first year. And it wasn't until I acted on my old behavior and felt the way I felt sober did I realize that I can't do that anymore. You know, I had to sort of try it and to see it wasn't working. And I retired from the bartending business, and I got a job initially in a retail store, and then I had an opportunity. My sister, that same sister, her company needed to hire someone in their payroll department, and they needed someone like right now, and I had little to no experience, and they hired me. So it was not of my making at all. And that began a career that I'm still in today. So you just never know how that's going to happen. Now, I failed to say I quit school in 12th grade. I did, however, take my GED, which was a smart thing to do. I don't know if I could have passed it 5 or 6 or, you know, actually it was 10 years later when I started college. But I'm glad I did take it because I had that behind me. And, you know, I think that as I really kind of got away from the drink and got to hear what recovery is and hear my story and your stories, I sort of pieced together my story by hearing yours. I loved speaker meetings. I really loved to hear that part about what happened. And that's how I learned what's sane, what's insane, because I thought my life was normal. And so as I got to hear you tell about your stories, I got to understand the insanity in mine. And, you know, I did not get in trouble with the police until I got sober. And 3 months into sobriety, actually, while I was in treatment, they visited my mother's house looking for me. And after I got out of treatment, I had to go turn myself in, and I was in big trouble. And so I, you know, did what I was supposed to do, which was, you know, face it. And I went and turned myself in, decided to get a public defender because I could not pay for an attorney with money. And so I was going to have a public defender. And I called my other attorney and said, I need my records because I now have a public defender. And he sort of argued with me a little bit. And when he realized I was serious, he said, I can't let you do that. You'll go to jail. And I'll take it. I won't ask anything of you. I'll take it. And so he did. And so that was one piece of that. The second piece was after I got the job, when I was 9 months sober, I took a job cocktail waitressing because I didn't have enough money to pay all my bills. And so one night a week I'm working in a bar, and in walks the cop that was investigating me, the undercover cop that I thought his name was Steve. Turns out it was something else. In walks him with a woman, and he sits down in my section, and I thought, oh, what am I going to do? So he kind of, and this was a cocktail lounge of a restaurant, so sometimes people would come in, and they would get called for the table, and they would leave. Well, he wasn't leaving. He wasn't eating dinner. He was going to just stay there, so I had to go over and see him, and I got him drinks, and we chatted, and he introduced me to his new partner, and not that I cared. And then I kind of thought, oh, he'll have one drink and leave, because he can't drive after having two drinks, right? He's a cop. And so he stayed and stayed, so I had to go back over, and he said, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. That's all he said, and he left. And I ended up getting off very easy. I think one or two charges were dropped. The ones that were there, you know, was probation, fines, and I ended up getting my whole record cleaned. And I can tell you I didn't deserve that because I did exactly what they accused me of doing. And I said as much. I'm very grateful for that. And I even got to get off probation early when I moved to Georgia. So, I was very lucky. But I really think that it's because I started changing already. I had done very little of the steps at 9 months. I don't think I had even done a four-step yet. But I was doing enough to where it was starting to change. And then I finally got a good sponsor. This is like sponsor number four or five. And she was a really nice young woman. And her name is Becky, and she looked nice. She dressed differently than I did. I'm still dressing like I'm going to a nightclub and I'm, going to a meeting. And she was clean. And that always struck me with her. She looked clean. And I think because I felt so dirty. And she, so I asked her to be my sponsor, and I finally did a fourth step and a fifth step with her, and then we went on and did the rest of the steps. And, I really am very grateful for that, because that's when things really started to change. That's when I really started to change. Nothing around me changed. I still had the probation to deal with. I still had a lot of wreckage of my past from a financial standpoint to deal with. And I made very little money, and I was, taking everything I could to live on and then used the rest to pay all the financial restitution. But I was able to do that, because I was starting to practice the principles that are in the steps and a part of our program. And, in the big book, in the there is a solution. It says that almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. And it definitely required it for me. If I would have not done that, I would have continued back out. And I heard somebody say, I think it was last night, if I'm not moving towards sobriety, I'm moving back to the drink. I got to go in one direction or the other, my choice. And before I started really working the steps, I was moving back to the drink, and I didn't even know it. I wasn't changing. And my behavior was the same. And when I started working the steps, I started to really see, about honesty, about self-respect, about consideration of others, all those things that most people learn when they're children. I didn't. I stopped stealing. I think I did have a couple amends to make to jobs after I got sober. You know, like if you give me the petty cash, I'm probably going to spend it. You know, I had to learn how to not do that, and things like that. But you know, I have learned how to do that. I have gone to the bank and gotten more money than I was supposed to get back and taken the money back when nobody would have known. You know, I learned how to do that here. I'd have thought that was a great day. You know, I just had a lucky day because I got extra money from the bank. And now I know that's not my money. I have to give it back. You know, that would have never occurred to me. And and it was the steps that took me there. And, you know, and it also says in there, there is a solution. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we would have had a deep and effective spiritual experience, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. And that has happened for me. And as a result, I want to do all I can to give back to AA, because it is AA that has given me a life that I have never experienced before this. And so I learned early on that... you know, part of sobriety and recovery is to be of service, and that I had to start, for me, by being of service to AA, and that I was to give back what I was so freely given, and I take that very serious. I think I might be rigid about that, and so I you know, my son, first of all, I don't know where he'd be if it weren't for me being sober. And he's lucky. He was six when I got sober. A lot of kids aren't that lucky. And you know, and I have a daughter today who's never seen me drink. And I have seven grandchildren that have never seen me drink. And they don't even know I'm an alcoholic, I don't think. I don't really know if they do or not. It's really not important in our relationship. And you know, if not for me giving back, I just don't feel like I would get all that. And you know, I could never possibly give back everything that I was given. There's not enough time in the day. There's just not enough ways I could do that. So the little bit that I do give back seems like, you know, it's barely enough, quite honestly. And so I was taught to be of service. Early on, I was secretary of my home group, long before I even knew what a secretary was. I don't think I ever did when I was there. It was my my newcomer home group, and there was about, 75 newcomers, and we were all trying to make it work. And, you know, I got to make coffee there and chair meetings, and then I moved to Georgia and got involved in public information, and got to be GSR. And everywhere I went, I always said, what can I do? I want a commitment, because that's what I was taught. You have a commitment, you have a sponsor, you work the steps, you have a home group. And so I'm constantly, you know, I have a home group, I got a sponsor, I need a commitment, and when that one's done, I need to know what the next one is. And you know, I'm grateful because I became somebody that says yes. And if you're an AA and you say yes, you will be asked. And we quickly find out who says yes, and that's who you go to. And you know, I got to do a lot of things. I got to represent our state at the our General Service Conference in New York, not because I'm anything special or any more sober than anybody else. It's because I said yes. And I truly believe that's why that is. And, you know, of that, the rewards that I got from that are incredible. Yes, I did service for AA, and I sacrificed my time and energy and my family's time to do that, but the rewards are unbelievable. I met people all over the country and grew myself and had other opportunities to work the steps and, you know, learned about the traditions, learned about the concepts. I use all of that in my business life, in my home life, and I would have never gotten a working knowledge of all that had I not been involved in service. There was really no reason for me to, and so I'm very grateful for that. I want to mention also, I went from a high school dropout to starting college at 28, and 12 years later, having a master's degree. And I only did that because of AA. And, you know, I would work full-time. I was doing AA service work, and I was going to school and raising a family, and I had a husband. And, you know, it sounds a little crazy, but it's what I do, and I, you know, and I would not have been able to do it had I not been sober. and had I not gone through the steps and had that spiritual awakening and had the spiritual experiences. And, you know, when I got here also, I believed in God, but I didn't think that God would help me. I felt like I was too far gone, and I was too bad. I grew up Catholic, so I broke all the Catholic rules. And so I just thought, I don't know how you undo that. And so I was sort of figuring that, you know, that's sort of behind me now. I'll just move on and take care of myself. And here was introduced to a higher power that was different than what I thought of God, or, you know, to me it was all sort of wrapped up in religion. And so I got to learn of a new concept of a higher power here, and I've built on that since, and I now have a relationship with a God that I've never had. I can't really explain it to you because I don't really know what it is, but I know it works for me, and I use the tools, and I'm seeking and taking action on a regular basis to improve that. And, you know, that, I think, is what our steps suggest for us, and that works. That definitely works, and I and that enables me to live life in a way that is within the principles that we have learned here. And that's not always easy. It's not always easy being honest, because sometimes I'm being honest about my bad behavior, and that's uncomfortable. You know, it's uncomfortable to be in an authoritative position at work and have to go to someone and say, "I'm really sorry, I screwed up." You know, or in front of a group of people, have to say that. But I've learned here that I don't have a choice. And if I do that, it's always better in the end. And then what has really happened, which is most surprising to me, is rather than them look at me as if I am, you know, less than or a weak person or whatever, they end up having more respect for me in the end. And I don't know how all that works. I just know it does work. And you know, again, I learned that here. I learned that by our amends process, the 8th step and the 9th step. And, you know, I just met someone at AA celebration we were having, and I said something to her that I, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought that really wasn't very nice. And I didn't know how to sort of recover, so I didn't say anything, and she didn't react, so I thought, I'm good. I couldn't stand it for a couple days. It was making me crazy. I didn't even know this woman. I had to get her phone number from my husband through her husband and call her up and just and make amends, because it was driving me crazy. And it was something that she said she didn't. She said, oh, I didn't even think twice about that. I don't know if she did or she was just trying to be nice, but it doesn't matter, because I was having trouble just sitting on that. I mean, I just felt like I needed to take care of it. I am so grateful for that, because I didn't know how to do that before I got here. I didn't know how to do that years into sobriety. I mean, not just when I got here, but years into sobriety. That has been a process over time. And for me, the road continues to narrow on what's acceptable from my behavior. And it's gotten pretty narrow, which I like, because I have nothing to clean up. You know, I don't have anything sitting there that needs to be dealt with, because I'm learning how to deal with it as it comes. And I can't think of a person today that I can't face, because I've either talked behind their back and feel guilty, or I've talked behind their back and they know about it, or, you know, I've stolen from them, or, you know, I slept with their husband or their boyfriend. I mean, there's nobody like that today that I can't face because I've done something. And that is a true freedom. and it's because of the steps that I have that. And, you know, I love that freedom. And I love the freedom of recovery and how I can, you know, just take care of things as they happen. And so today I am married. My husband Rusty's here. He spoke here a couple weeks ago. It's my second marriage, and I got divorced in sobriety, which was horrible. And I heard somebody say one time that who got divorced in sobriety that we should be careful not to take sides when that happens. And he talked about how hurtful that was to him and his ex-wife. And then I got to experience that. It is very hurtful. And the good news is I moved out of town before I got divorced. That was a good plan. And so I didn't have to face it. I heard about it, but I didn't really have to see it. But it is hurtful, and you never know the whole story. Trust me, you do not know the whole story. And so, but we got through it one day at a time, both working with our sponsors and in the program and going to a lot of meetings. We went to see a counselor, not to repair the marriage, but to help us with the divorce. And that person, he was like a family counselor. He helped us with how to deal with the children, the grandchildren, how we should behave with each other. And it was probably the best thing that we did around that. And I would have never known how to do that. But what that also did is prepare me for another relationship. And I spent 3 years looking at how do I not do that again. I was very hurtful to a lot of people, and I just don't ever want to be in that situation again. And I learned through inventory and a lot of using our tools kind of what my part in all that was. And, you know, my part started long before I met that person, actually. He is a very nice guy. It really had nothing to do with that. But my part started long before that. And so because of the steps... in working through that, I'm not one that works the steps once and then has this idea that I'm just going to do 10, 11, 12. That would have never worked in this scenario, I can tell you that. I do an inventory probably once every 18 months. And so maybe 2 years, maybe 12, depending on what's going on. And that really helped me for a marriage I'm in now, which is so much different and such a good relationship, and I'm a better partner than I ever was. And still, I have a lot to improve on, but I'm much better than I ever was. And I have a daughter that's 22 and just moved to New York City and went to, like, all the way through high school, and then she went to undergraduate. Now she's going to graduate, like, all in a row. Very sort of normal child, which I cannot relate to at all. My son was kind of like me. I had a lot of dysfunction for several years. I had to learn how to be a mother. I didn't know how to do that. So all that took a while. That recovery was long. And so he ended up... I guess he finally made it through high school. It was painful. And then he went into the Navy, quit the Navy, and then he got his girlfriend pregnant. And so at 20, he had his first child, and he eventually went to college part-time while he was raising his family. They got married on child number 3. They now have 7. He has his own business. He seems to be a normal drinker, he's a responsible young man, and I don't know how that happened. It shouldn't have happened. God had a lot to do with that. He said to me when he was pregnant, when his wife was pregnant, well, his girlfriend at the time was pregnant with their first child, he said, "I'm not going to be the kind of father my father was." And I can tell you, he has not. And he is probably going to bring his half-brother, his father's other son. His father passed away about 10 years ago. He is in jail right now, his half-brother, and he was raised by the same drug addict father, and until he died. His father died early, probably from drug abuse. His mother, who I just learned they were in jail together, was murdered about a year and a half ago, and he is going to, when he gets out of jail in December, my son's going to bring him down here and help him sort of create a life for himself. And, you know, I'm a little nervous about that because I know how those people are because I'm one of them. But I just think what an opportunity for this young man. He's 22 years old. He has no idea what life is about. He can tell you all about what jail's about. He can tell you all about, you know, drug use and all that stuff. I don't know if he's a drug addict. I don't even know what he does. It doesn't matter to me. But he has no idea about life. And and I'm really excited for him. He seems like a really nice kid. And when my son went to see him, they, it was like they've been together their whole lives. And there was an instant connection. So very excited for him. But that's the kind of young man he's grown into. And that's no doing of mine. My daughter is similar. You know, what I do know is they saw me, as they were growing up, giving back to AA on a regular basis. And that was their example. I never really thought much about it till my daughter gave me a chip, and she said, she always does so much. And then when I think she's done a lot, she does more. And so I thought, well, I don't know if that's good or bad. But I think it's a good example. I think that what they see is I'm being of service, and that's who they've become. My daughter has a very expensive education, and she's probably going to work for a community organization somewhere because she loves helping people. And that's fine. She won't make a lot of money, and, you know, I don't know how we'll pay for education, but we'll pay for it. But, you know, that's who she is. And I think she learned that here from what we're taught and how we help each other. I can't be more grateful. It is a miracle that I'm standing here, and I thank you for that. Thank you.